Abby Norman was a dancer. She was a 19-year-old sophomore at Sarah Lawrence College and fiercely independent. One thing she never saw in herself was a sick person, but that changed in an instant.
I got up one morning, went to get in the shower. I was overwhelmed by this pain, and it was sort of, you know, abdominal pelvic, but it was just really sudden. It just kind of like came out of nowhere and just gripped me.
After that, doctor after doctor tried to explain away Abby's pain as anxiety or sexual dysfunction, even as completely imagined. It was a daily struggle just to be believed. Meanwhile, the pain grew.
I just went on this quest, not just to figure out what that particular pain was from, but then subsequently the health problems that came from that, what the next 7 going on 8 years of my life was defined by.
Eventually, she got a diagnosis of endometriosis. That's when the tissue lining of the uterus grows in other parts of the body. It's estimated that at least 10% of women suffer from endometriosis. Norman documents her journey in a new book. It's called Ask Me About My Uterus, A Quest to Make Doctors Believe in Women's Pain. She sat down with Takeaway producer Alexandra Botee to share her story, starting with the minutes and days after the pain first struck.
I really didn't want there to be anything wrong. I didn't want to be sick. And in fact, I would go so far as to say that I just felt like I couldn't be, because I was on a scholarship that was contingent upon my ability to perform academically and to go to class. And so for at least the first day and a half or so, I continuously tried to drag myself to classes, and then, you know, ultimately spent most of the time in bed sleeping and not eating enough or drinking enough even, and was forced to go to the emergency room, and finally had to kind of accept that, okay, there's something going on. And of course, what I didn't know is that it would take multiple trips to the emergency room and being told, you know, you're probably maybe a little neurotic here. Like, maybe there's a little like stress going on. I mean, this is like a stress type of response. And I could not have really known at the time that that was going to be the rhetoric that would chase me throughout this entire experience.
Were there times when you were actually given misinformation, information that sent you on a wrong path to thinking about your health?
Well, the information that I really have ever received from the medical profession about endometriosis at first just didn't exist. And then subsequent from that was all very outdated and to a large extent inaccurate. And I would not have known that had I not been digging after all of these months of saying there's something very wrong in my body, and then having ultrasounds, exams, blood tests, and then doctors saying there's nothing wrong, you're stressed out, there's nothing wrong, maybe you pulled a muscle. When I finally did have the first sort of exploratory surgery, it turned out that I had a large endometrioma, which is a type of ovarian cyst that is blood-filled. It had actually displaced my ovary and had torqued my fallopian tube. So if you imagine like that, when you wring out a washcloth, that's what the tube looked like. And so after that surgery, the surgeon was like, I don't know how we missed that. So my question is, now that I'm out of the surgery and I'm in recovery, like, I'm guessing that this is all fine now because you took it out, right? And she said, well, no, we drained it and we wrapped it in this surgical mesh, and we couldn't have taken it out without, you know, messing with the tube. And, you know, I was 19, and the primary concern seemed to be around fertility, which no one had particularly asked my opinion about. And at that point, all I really cared about was that I didn't want to be in pain anymore. I didn't want to be sick. What I really wanted more than anything else was to know that that would never happen to me again. Maybe 18 months after the first sort of big medical crisis that I had, you know, my apocalyptic shower, I kind of ended up at that level of illness again. I had another sort of acute situation. Only that time I could take my boyfriend. And so then the doctors could look at him and say, she telling the truth, you know, she just being dramatic about this.
Did they do that?
Yeah, they did. Yeah, they looked to him to sort of corroborate my pain. I had been seeing these things one-on-one you know, me and a doctor or me in an emergency room. You know, I had been doing that. But then suddenly it was different.
At what point did you realize that other women might be having the same experience, that this wasn't unique to you in your life?
In the midst of all of this, one of the greatest assets has been the internet. I had originally just kind of started talking about it in broader strokes. Then all of a sudden I started getting emails, or I started getting Facebook messages from people I didn't know who had read something that I had written. These women are all living in different places. They're of different ages. They have, you know, different marital status. They have different levels of education. They're of different races and different life experience. And yet when they email me or they Facebook message me, it's never just to say, yes, I felt this way. Yes, I have these symptoms. And they do say that. But what they say is, I have literally had this exact conversation with a doctor. I have literally had them say to me, you're stressed. This is in your head. You're not coping with your menstrual cycle, and you should be able to cope with it. You must not like sex, and that's why it's painful for you. This is happening in so many places, and it's happening consistently, regardless of where these women are interacting within the healthcare system.
What reaction did you get when you brought this to the medical community as you started to realize what a phenomenon this was?
I got to speak at a medical conference at Stanford University. And what I remember the most about that was that after I gave this presentation, this doctor came up to me. He had this really severe look on his face. And so I thought, he's going to ream me out. And he looked at me and he said, I can't stop thinking about how many people I might have done this to. You know, he was an emergency room doctor. There was clearly, to me, this moment for him of just an awareness that throughout his career, he had never had that moment before.
Is that how we fix this? How do we change this for women?
One of the things that I think about a lot in terms of what would have made a difference to me in my interactions with doctors is that early on, if they had really been willing to just admit that they didn't know, rather than trying to blame me or rather than trying to just totally drop me because the problem or me was complicated, I think that would have been a good start, because then that would have opened up the conversation, not even necessarily with me, but maybe for them with their colleagues, about where these gaps in knowledge exist or where the bias might come in. And so the task really is to have a willingness to step back and do a little self-examination and realize that even if they think, oh, no, I don't hold any of those biases. Perhaps the individual doctor may not, but the overarching structure that they work in is very much still beholden to a lot of those beliefs. And that is where it needs to be challenged. And the onus cannot be on the patient to do that.
But what would you say to women who find themselves up against this system, even if ultimately we need broader change, more systemic change? What do you say to you a few years ago?
What we're seeing more broadly right now is this movement around, you know, women coming forward and saying, yes, this also happened to me, but also asking that women be believed. And I think that all of that is going to continue to be very important, but particularly where these issues are concerned, where so many of these interactions happen just between a woman and a doctor, at least at the beginning. I mean, yes, maybe eventually there's an advocate, there's a spouse, there's someone else there. But in the beginning, a lot of times these things really begin with the woman sitting across from the doctor. But then even before she gets to that point, it's just the woman sitting with herself. And I can't tell you how many times, I mean, and honestly, how many times have you heard stories of a woman who said, well, I just thought the stomach ache was stress, or I just thought that I was having, you know, a weird in between bleeding on my cycle and that it was just stress, or I just didn't want to deal with this because my kids had things going on at school, or my husband had, you know, something going on at his job, and I just didn't want to focus on this thing that was happening to me because all these other people needed me to focus on them. I mean, how many times do we hear women say things like that, and then they find out like 6 months later that they've had, you know, ovarian cancer that's been, you know, growing in their body for 6 months or a year, and they didn't even admit to themselves that something was wrong because they didn't feel like they had permission. They didn't feel like they could put their needs ahead of somebody else's. There's something about that too that is so pervasive in this culture, that even before a woman might get into the healthcare system and have that kind of interaction where she might be not believed or taken seriously, which is going to prolong her ability to have those issues dealt with by months, if not years, which is going to create, you know, a more dire situation for her. She may have already prolonged that interaction with the healthcare system herself because she doesn't believe herself, or she doesn't think that she should be the priority, that her well-being should be the priority. And I think that's really what it comes down to, is that, yes, we need other people to believe the women, but women need to believe themselves.
Abby Norman is a science writer and author of the new book, Ask Me About My Uterus, A Quest to Make Doctors Believe a Woman's Pain. She spoke with The Takeaway's Alexandra Boti. Have you ever felt a doctor didn't take your pain or other symptoms seriously? We asked for your stories.
Hi, my name is Pilar. I live in East Hampton, Massachusetts. Shortly after my son was born in 2006, my body began behaving very strangely. My joints would seize up and then refuse to move. I couldn't hold my head up, and I'd have to pop my lumbar spine back into place in order to walk. By 2011, I had had 3 seizures and had been bedridden for weeks. The pain was incredible, frightening, and bizarre. Over the next 5 years, I saw no fewer than 8 doctors who all dismissed me as simply having fibromyalgia, and they all referred me to psychiatry for exaggerating my symptoms. I was finally diagnosed with Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, a rare genetic connective tissue disorder. This kind of dismissal very much felt like the Victorian diagnosis of female hysteria, and it sadly remains a scourge in the medical community today. Thank God for the doctor who gave me my true diagnosis.
My name is Joan Vorderbruggen, and I'm calling from Minneapolis, Minnesota. When I was a teenager, I had excruciating periods to the point of vomiting and being in a fetal position on the floor in my bathroom. And I went to my general physician for 3 years complaining that I needed help and that this was not normal, and was always told that it was normal. And at 17 years old, I actually had kind of a standoff in the doctor's office, and I screamed at him and said, it is not normal for me to be in this much pain, and if you don't know how to help me, then admit it and send me to someone who does. And he finally sent me to an OBGYN specialist. I was diagnosed with endometriosis 5 laparoscopy surgeries later. I finally had some relief.
Sharon from Somerville, South Carolina. Yes, I have had problems with them not taking me seriously. Pretty much as a woman, most male doctors tend to blame everything on either hormones or stress. I can't tell you how many times I've changed doctors because of that.
My name is Elizabeth Ron, and I'm calling from Beersford, South Dakota. As a woman in my 60s, I have spent years trying to get physicians / PAs to listen to me. After several years of trying to get my PA to refer me to a physician for thyroid issues, I finally just found a new doctor and went to him without a referral.
Hi, my name is Michelle Grothstein, and I'm calling you from Kaneohe, Hawaii. I got married at 18 in Florida, and my husband and I knew from the start we didn't want kids. When my husband and I went to my family doc and said my husband wanted a vasectomy, Doc said, if we do anything, we're going to do it to your wife. I am not performing a vasectomy on a 20-year-old man. Eventually, I got pregnant despite birth control, and by then was living in Hawaii. My compassionate and kind female OBGYN tied my tubes after my son was born. No male doc would even listen to me when I said I didn't want kids. My son was the result of IUD failure. I love him for sure, but I would have still been very happy not to have ever been pregnant.
This is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.